You're listening to the 40 Thrive Podcast, the show created for women 40 and beyond, ready to shake things up. And now, your host, Jackie McDougall.
Welcome to the 40 Thrive Podcast. If you tuned in last week, you met Moana Dixon. Moana is the founder of The Hunted Fox, where she creates home decor products that exude style, adding the utmost of comfort to your space. Hand-woven, ethnic, vintage, and made by hand in their custom design studio in the LA Arts District. Moana has been so generous to offer exclusive to my 40 Thrive listeners. Everything on her website is 30% off. That's right. Everything on huntedfox.co is 30% off. Use the promo code THRIVE at checkout at huntedfox.co and let me know what you bought. There's so many great things over there. I'm going shopping right after this. So in this episode, part two, Moana talks more about what really went down on The Bachelor, the lie she told that she regrets to this day, and she reveals how her experience at 26 years old still has a huge impact on who she is today as a 40-year-old woman. So where do we leave off in part one? Well, Moana was sharing how she was becoming friends with the producers, even getting to see tapes and hear inside stories of the other women. She was going behind the scenes. She was getting that insider view. So today, we're going to start off this episode right where we left off. So here is the continuation of my conversation with Moana Dixon.
I saw the whole thing from a 360 perspective, and I think they gave him some of the insight too, and what was transpiring between us and why I became such good friends with one of the producers to this day is because we really had a journey with what then became a group of friends.
Do you think that there was any manipulation happening here?
I think, of course, there's manipulation because it's not real that you're in an extended period of time where life doesn't interfere.
That's so true.
That's the biggest manipulation is that you don't have your friends that you're saying, which they try to create a few of those things, but it's kind of bullshit. You know?
But if you were home, it's not like you'd be going out with the producers at this point.
No. And right? It's the way that they introduce you to his friends is so cheesy. It's like they made us do like a talent. It was so dumb and like talk about a wedding ring size or answer a stupid question. It's not like sitting at a dive bar and, you know, watching a game and getting to know his buddies.
Right.
It's kind of lame the way they do all that stuff. And it's not normal for me to bulldoze into my parents' house with cameras and a dude.
How did they handle it?
My parents are really solid people with a lot of integrity. And they were not entertained by the cameras. Any bit of kind of producing or interrupting in the normal flow of their ethos might have gotten a funky look, which happened to land on camera, which then was perfect for editing. So balls, yeah. You know? And he didn't get a fair shot at getting to know my family either because that was awkward.
Was he trying, do you think?
Yeah.
I mean, at this point, you're feeling it.
He'd already on the beach earlier that day before we met my family. He'd been asking me to move to Colorado. And I mean, we've been talking about stuff after that, before was even a thing.
And is he having, you know, dates with other people that are similar?
Yes. And he's telling me about them. I mean, I think he'd like maybe kiss one of the girls. He was telling me everything that was happening. And so he was sharing and confiding.
Relationship. Yeah.
And really confiding in me. And he was confiding, and we were confiding in each other the anxiety of the production and that this wasn't our thing. And I remember saying to him, gosh, I'm sitting on a beach wearing a full face of makeup. This is weird. We really connected on a lot of the things that we didn't really agree with about the production. It felt like we had this, which it does and it should when you really connect with another person. You kind of have this cocoon and you're kind of in it. And I think what really did destabilize him is that because they're producing a show, they couldn't have just the Moana and Travis show. They had to have the run of their show. It has to follow the schematic. It has to follow the thing.
Otherwise, it'd be four episodes.
There you go. From the time we connected, it was on and it pissed everybody else off. And so they had to create circumstances that exposed possible drama and allowed the show to follow its course of all of the other things that they had planned and lined up in the production. With that being said, when he was choosing the girls, like we'd kind of talked about it, and he said, well, I'm going to keep her because I think she's, you know, she's just a friend and I'm not attracted to her at all.
So he would be strategic and keep the ones that he didn't have a thing for.
Yeah.
And probably he helped with producing. Like if you have someone who's a little nutty and she's going to get ratings, Do you think that the producers were like, hey, keep her because we need her?
I think they probably tried to, and I think they were successful in doing that in the beginning. Mm-hmm. But I think he is a person of integrity also. Okay. And I think he said no. I think that was what was also why they kind of gave up and let us hang out off camera a lot, was because neither one of us would do what they were asking. We just said, no, I'm not going to do that.
But they ultimately wanted a great connection. So they let you kind of,
they definitely
that.
Stuck little needles in for sure. And they had created some drama around me in the house. And the drama was, I didn't want to be there. Now I wanted to be there.
Okay.
So we have this big blowout with the girls. I walk downstairs. I hear them in the living room all trashing me and saying I'm emotionally unstable because I wanted to go home. And now I'm, you know, this guy and I are like magnets.
Right.
And I walk in on them and said something to the effect of, you guys want to say whatever it is you're saying to me, because I'm here now standing in front of you. And gosh, forgive me for having a heart because it changed. And I didn't show up here to care or fall for somebody, but I did. So what? Get over it.
Right.
And so that was the big blow up.
Mm-hmm.
And the girl who was his friend, she really, I really think she was just, she was competitive against everybody else. And I think there was even one point where she says to his mom and on camera, his mom asks her, do you really like my son or do you just want to win? And
wow.
She says on camera, oh no, I just want to win. And that was the girl he ended up choosing, by the way.
Wait, so the one that he chose was the one that he told you he was friends with and
yes.
wasn't attracted to?
Yes. There
well,
was
F
a reason.
Him.
I know. There was a reason why. I was just not. His parents.
Are you comfortable talking about the reason
totally.
Why?
Yeah, totally. And again, this is my, I wish that I could even go and kind of watch the whole last thing again, but his family shows up. And, you know, these are parents from the Midwest who have raised an incredible older daughter, and she was married with two kids and who was awesome. And she showed up and we just clicked right away. I would say the only lie that I ever told that has haunted me to this day was to his sister and her husband. They asked me a question about my personal faith, and I totally lied because I didn't want the production to use it against me, because we had kind of experienced maybe some intimacy and things that were probably out of the boundaries of conventional, like maybe like a religious moniker. And I didn't want to say, they asked me, oh, are you a Christian? And I said, no, oh, I'm spiritual. I like danced around it because I didn't want for them to use that, me saying I'm a Christian and then like show me
doing something
un-Christian-like. Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
I just didn't want it to be fuel for a fire.
Yeah.
And
so you said no,
yes.
But you are?
I said, no, I'm not.
Okay.
Which was
but you
a lie.
Are.
Yes.
Okay.
And that was a lie. And his family, they're really faith-based and rooted and grounded, whatever. And I totally just sold myself out. That was the only time that I
so
really
in actuality,
said something untrue.
If you said yes, they probably would have been more supportive, you think?
Yes. And the way that I think, I don't know, I'm guessing, but the way that it breaks down is his parents just probably a lot more conservative. They show up and their son, who they've been, you know, he's been becoming a doctor and they've been probably building his life with him for 30 some odd years. And at the time, I think he was 34 and he's about to graduate from, or I think graduate from Vanderbilt, or he is finishing up his residency at Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. So he's now going to be out into the world and they're at the home stretch here. And here shows up this girl from California.
And they can't even figure out your nationality.
Yeah, exactly. And their son is all kinds of upside down. And we were pretty upside down for each other. You know what it's like when you encounter someone that you know very well and you're going, where is this from?
Yep.
Who is this person? And I need to meet them. By this time, all of the rest of the stuff had happened. We'd spent the night in another country. Like stuff's happened.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff had happened.
You're not just like kissing in the halls anymore.
Like, definitely
this is full
not.
Blown,
nope.
So to speak.
Negative. So yeah, we'd had some time off camera.
Yeah.
And so we've really connected personally.
Mm-hmm.
And now
do you think at this point he's having sex with other women too?
No. And it's kind of funny because the other gal, I definitely think, I know they made out. She, super funny story. Who is the third gal in the mix that he was attracted to. And he told me he was attracted to her and that he said, I'm going on this next overnight date. And he said, I'm uncomfortable. He goes, but I am attracted to her, but it's just not the same thing. And I actually, it was so weird. I just really understood that. I understood his heart. I really, you know, when you just know somebody and you're able to just say, I really trust you and I understand. And if that's what we'll navigate through it. I really had a lot of empathy for him. And I understood that it was a difficult situation and whatever. So she ended up living with me for a couple of months.
Girl number three?
Yeah. While she was moving out to Los Angeles, and she told me every detail. I don't know, maybe second base. There, it was like heavy petting. I don't even know. Whatever.
But it wasn't what you guys
Yeah, I think things had begun to move into like beyond like heavy making out, I think, if I recall. And like maybe a shirt had come off and he stopped and said, I can't do this. Which
so
I think
did
is fair.
She feel like they were like falling in love, or did she just feel like we're attracted to each other and this is fun?
Yeah. I think she was attracted.
Which is a totally reasonable place to be fair. In that short period of time.
Yeah. And I was done for. Yeah. I was like just a total hot mess.
Yeah. And so you and he were, you know, obviously having this off camera romance, but then girl number one, what's her name?
Sarah Stone.
Sarah Stone. So Sarah Stone, though, he only keeps around because they're friends.
Yeah.
And he's not attracted to her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so when do you discover that this may not be the case? On the final day?
I don't think it ever was not the case. What ended up happening was this whole, his parents, his family's here now.
Okay.
And I'm this major distraction that they did not plan for their son's life. And I sit down with his parents. And by this time, we've had some very intimate episodes personally. Mm-hmm. It's not normal to not speak to a person for I don't know how long. It's really not normal to have all that go down and you don't connect at all. And the next time you see them, you're walking in a house to meet their parents.
Wait, so they separated you two?
Well, yeah, he had to go on to the next couple of dates. So we have this, you know, we spend the night and all the fun stuff that happens all night happens. And then you don't talk to the person. So imagine you're in this big epic romance.
Right.
And then now I guess the term would be you're ghosted. But it's forced because the production is what it is.
Right.
So you can't talk to him. He doesn't even know how to get a hold of me if he wanted to.
And it's not like he didn't want to. It was
But it's really abnormal. Then instead of seeing him after we've whatever, I meet his family.
Oh my God.
Like, I don't get to meet him. We don't get to kind of connect.
He wasn't there?
No, he was. But he and I don't get that moment where we get to connect first and then whatever, regroup. It was all kinds of awkward. So I was really destabilized. And I had all these emotions that were really overwhelming and confusing because things went way further than I had ever. I was adamant that they were never going to go there.
Right.
In fact, maybe my mistake is I told him they were never going to go there.
Mm, right.
And so I, you know, I did that thing. Yeah. And so of course they went there. And then now for women, as you know, it's all kinds of complicated the second that stuff happens.
Well, you were already feeling things.
Yes. So, but then it just got worse.
Yeah.
And then we can't speak. And then I meet his family.
So was it just the one time? Or were you guys having sex for a while? You could shut me up at any time, girl. I'm fascinated by this. I don't know if your mom's listening to the 43 podcast, but
I'm just not going to share the link.
Okay.
it was exciting, and it was the one night that we stayed in Venice. It was maybe I'd say from beginning of the evening until we had to leave the next day.
Okay.
So just multiple occurrences. Yeah.
That's young, 26.
Yeah,
for you.
Young and energetic. Life is good.
Now it's like, I need 3 days, honey.
Right. No. I mean, there's,
Okay.
So
this happens in Venice. Then then you see him at the house. It's all awkward.
In front of his parents.
Yeah. Who are uber Christian.
Totally. And as am I, and lying about it. And like, we just threw down a couple days ago. You know what I mean? And all kinds of very personal things have happened.
And so you're afraid if you say you're Christian that they're going to say, oh, really? Because we have the tape.
Sure.
Well, that sounds
about
right.
Up on. Sure. Totally. I didn't want to be a hypocrite.
Yeah.
Totally. And I didn't know any of that. I just felt like I felt very unsafe. And it's because also this had already happened. And now I'm with his sister and their kids at a park. And they're asking me these questions.
Right.
I felt like that was a question that was produced.
Yes.
And I felt like I just saw a trap because I think they knew that we just had a wild.
So do you think his parents were like, no, absolutely not. She's not good for you.
Oh, for sure. Now I'm like starting to actually drink the cocktails because I'm feeling all kinds of awkward. What really, we sat down and this is just like imprinted in my brain. So this isn't part of what I'm not remembering accurately. Mm-hmm. It's also on film. Mm-hmm. So we sit down with his mom and his dad, and his mom is just probably trying to unwind or figure out what the heck is going on. And she looks at me and says, what is it about my son? What is going on here? And I could tell they were just like, oh, whoa, this is a lot.
Were you the first one?
No, they had met Sarah before me.
Okay.
And I think he'd probably shared with his sister, hey, I'm really into this girl. And now the family's there to either be the cooler or to figure it out or whatever. Right. They're there to be a family. And his mom asks me, and I'm sitting next to the father and the dad, and I started to get emotional. Mm-hmm. And I said to his mom, I said, I have never looked into the eyes of another person and seen my own soul shining back to me or shining back at me. And he and I had this really intense, just kind of deep, when you walk into a room, like you just have a whole conversation, like from across the room kind of connection. I mean, it was like something you could sink your teeth into. That's why there was drama in the house and everybody kind of was annoyed. So his parents obviously see all this and it's this energy that's going on between us and they want to figure out what the heck is going on and how disruptive I possibly can be in his life, I'm guessing. And which was probably really disruptive at that time because I still hadn't figured a lot of my shit out.
Yeah.
And I really thought that I had, again, all my stuff is packed in pretty boot boxes. Yeah. And I don't realize how unaware I am of all my bullshit.
Right.
And
because the shelves that the boxes are on are absolutely unstable.
Oh, And I'm like wearing a mask. And at this point, you know, I'm like, you know, dressed in a turtleneck and riding boots with pearls on and my hair pulled back and trying to look as, you know, like Midwestern proper. His mom, I think she kind of melted. She heard me. She understood. She knew. And she knew also, I think, that they were in trouble. And his dad, being stern and understandable, looked at me and said something that just I'll never forget. And it completely disrupted my entire life, but it was totally true and on point. And he looked at me and he said, he said, you look like you've experienced a lot of pain in your life. And I said, yes, I have. And he said, my son hasn't. And I just, like, I could feel like shreds of my person just like falling off of me and just crumbling in front of him. Wow. Like it was like, that was it. Game over. At that time, me, 26, I was devastated. I was so wounded and hurt by that because I felt like he was telling me I wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
Me at 40 knows that that was me saying I wasn't good enough to me because he was just exposing all the stuff that I hadn't really dealt with or was afraid of and all my wounds that showed up right there in that conversation. And yeah, he's right. He was totally right. The greatest worst thing that ever happened to me was this experience. Because I think that had the stakes not been so high, I might not have been broken so badly. And I might have turned 45 and had some big thing happen in my life and have to start that journey. So it's been for me 14 years now. And to be fair, there probably hasn't been a day that's gone by that I haven't thought about some part of all of it. Ironically, that sounds weird and psycho.
Not even a little bit, but I just have to point out,
it was just such,
though,
so big for me.
Yeah, that this dad probably was saying that you weren't good enough. However,
and that would have been fair.
Like you were good enough, that wouldn't have even hit you.
Totally.
Do you know what I mean?
Like, of course,
if I tell you, like,
totally,
that wall over there is purple, and 100%. You're like, it's not, because it's not purple.
Yep.
But because he said it and you were already feeling it, it was like
100%.
Boom.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So it landed.
Yeah.
And
are you able to have any personal private moments with Travis at this point during this?
No.
Oh my God.
I think we have a dinner and the gal, Sarah Stone, she was the gal that did not like me from moment one. Didn't like me at all. And it's okay. We don't have, not everybody's your brand.
Well, I always say you're not for everyone.
Totally.
I say that to
you
my
can't
students,
be for everybody.
My kids. Like if you really walk around thinking that you're meant for everyone and everyone's meant for you, you are going to be very, very unhappy.
Totally. I could equivocate and say she just didn't get me, whatever. It doesn't matter. I just wasn't her brand and her, not mine. And that's okay. I was really cordial to her and she was a little sassy Southern. Gave all this real sweet kind of
backhanded, like, approved her.
Oh, totally. And she just didn't like me. So she actually said some things to me, or I think she said some things to his sister about me that were really, I don't know what they were, but just not, they didn't make me look very good. So by the time I met his parents and his sister, I kind of already had a bad rap.
Yeah.
That was a little unfair.
Yeah.
Because it came from a girl who kind of just wanted to beat me out or beat me to the punch.
Well, yeah. I mean, what a benefit you get to be number one going in. So then you could set the table for the rest of the women.
Yeah.
Well, did three of you go to the house? Or?
Just two.
Just two. Okay. So at this point, girl number three is gone.
Yeah. And she was, so Sarah's the safety net. And now this is where the production starts to produce. They're kind of now messing with, and they needed to create some sort of a drama.
Yeah.
So that's why I think they, and I don't know who fed or fueled or did what, but all I do know is that long after the fact, Travis was going into or calling the producer saying, when are you going to show the crap on Moana? And they kept saying, what do you mean? We don't have any. And he said, well, what did she do that made everybody hate her? What did she do? And they said, we don't have anything. She didn't do anything. But the other gal mm-hmm. and the production allowed him to believe that there was some big something, I don't know, about me.
Oh.
And then that rolls over to his family. So if you kind of go back to when we were first speaking about producing, mm-hmm. you can plant seeds of deceit.
Yeah.
And it's really wild because we can do that to ourselves and we can do that for other people. That's part of the journey of life. But in this environment where there's producers and there's people who are seeing everything, if they want to create drama around the idea that there's something wrong or something, some secret or something that you don't know about this person, it's not that hard to do.
Right.
And to be fair, I'm not cut from the same cloth that everybody else is. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that, but not everybody else is okay with that.
Right.
So maybe that's just what rubbed her the wrong way, and that's okay. So his sister had asked me on camera, why don't the girls like you? And I said, I don't know. But this is a really crazy environment. It's really weird. Kind of, I don't know, had the agenda to produce a TV show, but I really care about your brother. And I just kind of moved on because it didn't mean anything to me. So the next time after I meet his family, we go to dinner that night, meet his family, and I just totally fall apart. I mean, after this conversation with his mom and dad, I was a mess. Like I shattered completely. I make him dinner and it's awkward when I see him for the first time. Now, mind you, we've gone from spending the night together to meeting his family to now I'm meeting him in a park and then making him dinner. And it's super weird. And he asks me again, what's the thing? Why don't the girls like you? And I foolishly blew it off again because I didn't know. And I said, I don't know. And I don't really even want to give air to it. And I probably needed to slow down mm-hmm. and ask him to help me understand why he's asking and where he's coming from so that we could unpack the conversation. But I didn't have the maturity or maybe the depth of self or awareness to be able to do that then. So I blew it off. And to him, something was wrong with me.
Oh.
So not only is he building his case.
You're hiding it.
Totally. His sister had asked me, this girl, Sarah, who I think he trusted her. I think they became friends.
Yeah.
Genuinely, really. They had a lot in common from Nashville, both. And his parents now, everybody's got this question mark about me. Well, the question mark was definitely instilled from somewhere. I don't know where or what. Or maybe I did do something that they just thought was weird. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'll never know.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it'll ever matter. The bottom line is that at the end of the day, he didn't propose to her. He gave her a friend. He gave her the ring that they forced him to buy. He wanted to buy her like a necklace. And he put it on a necklace and gave it to her as like a friendship necklace. Again, that happens first. And I end up going.
And you don't know this?
No, but I knew something was wrong.
Yeah.
I don't know how to explain it. I woke up that morning.
Well, it sounds like he's a big people pleaser too. And that when mommy and daddy weren't, who probably paid for, I'm sorry, I don't know this guy, and I've worked in TV and I've worked in daytime TV. And he just sounds like a spoiled little brat, not even a spoiled little brat, but like a mom and dad paid for the education. They've done all this stuff. Look at all the things they've done for them. They're not happy. You know, there are a lot of people who live this way, who mm-hmm. try to please, you know, their parents, their community, their whatever. Like you were scandalous in that, you know, your background didn't match. I don't know. It's just, I'm saying this as someone who did not watch the show, mm-hmm. as just hearing this story and how it unfolded, it sounds like he was a total coward.
That definitely was the word I used privately at that time, but not until and that's not fair because I wasn't angry at first. I would say that I don't necessarily know that that's fair. And I've had long conversations with my father about this. Mm-hmm. And my dad said he's respecting his family and he's honoring his parents and he's respecting his family. And to be fair, the conditions under which I met his family were very unfair to him and to me. And so shame on the producers for that. They were just there to protect and love their son. And I can't imagine what it's like to have gone 34 years with your son and building a life to then have it all really threatened. Because I believe personally that I had the ability at that time to be a totally disruptive element in his life because it was that big. And I think they saw that. And I think that really concerned them, mm-hmm. as it would any parent. And I get that.
Yeah, but the parents of a grown ass man.
I get it.
If you have the ability to be that disruptive in a grown ass man's world, I feel like there's something not right to begin with.
Fair enough. But to scale back and really try to
This is your experience and your 26-year-old experience. I'm talking about as a 48-year-old woman hearing the story.
I've had 14 years to put this into context.
Yeah.
And
so I apologize if I'm too pushy.
For the first seven, I was brutalized. I mean, this annihilated me.
Well, did you think that you weren't enough? I mean,
Oh my gosh, of course.
I can only imagine in the beginning that it was you weren't enough.
Yes, of course I felt that way. And so much. To the degree, which is also why I said probably the best, worst thing that ever happened to me, because it really forced me. It shattered apart this entire 26 years worth of bravado and bullshit that I had painted into this pretty mask that I thought when I was wearing, everybody else believed of me. So in spite of the fact that, yeah, maybe they felt that way, maybe it wasn't true, maybe it was true, who cares? In my life, the way that it showed up was the most devastating thing that had ever happened to me. I was head over heels in love with this dude. And he was asking me to move to Colorado. And I was like, I was in. Never would have left his side. Yeah. I would have been his warrior for life. It all just crumbled. And when he was telling me, saying, I can't choose you if I follow my heart, I knew he was lying to me. And he was lying to himself. It wasn't even to me. The weirdest thing is I was so connected and plugged into him in a way that I don't think I've ever been with another person in my life, that I was really able to set myself aside. Not even, I didn't need to set myself aside. I saw him hurting in front of me, saying things he didn't want to say to me that I knew would hurt me, but I was fully engaged with how he was experiencing and emoting. I had such overwhelming understanding of how difficult it was for him, but I also knew that it wasn't true. I will say that the one thing that I will probably regret for the rest of my life is that there's a hallway in between this kind of ballroom where we were, when he tells me that he can't choose me or whatever. And I remember just, I feel like I didn't breathe for 5 minutes. It just, you know when something really gives you, you know when something is your breath or a person is your breath?
Yeah.
And it's like the air just gets sucked out of the room and you just, I couldn't move and I couldn't breathe. And I was just trying to hold it together. And we walk into this hallway where there are no cameras, there's no audio, there's nothing. And he's holding onto my hand and I'm just trying to run out of there. And he's pulling me back to stop and try to say something to me. And I was just so terrified. And I just didn't want to suffer another second of humiliation in front of the cameras. I wanted it to be over. I didn't in a million years think that you'd never get this moment back. You'll never be able to have this conversation again. You'll never be able to unpack this. And he tried to stop me so that he could explain himself, and I wouldn't let him. And I would say it's probably the thing that I think I'll regret for the rest of my life, because there might have been something in there that would have helped me reconcile this maybe sooner or differently. I don't know. But I drug him down the stairs. And again, he hugged me and he kept holding on to me. And I kept trying to push away from him. I think on camera, I'm pushing against him like, let me go.
Right.
And he was just gripping me. And he just kept looking at me, just kind of shaking his head with tears kind of welling his eyes, you know, welling up and saying, you're so beautiful. You're just so beautiful. Like he couldn't say anything else. They never show this.
So they had cut at this point.
No.
Or,
oh my God. No.
Following, but they didn't.
Okay. They've got all of this in the editing. It didn't ring true to show all of this and then have it end that way. So they don't show all of this, but it's brutal. This goes on. Like the whole thing was, it went on for so long showed a snippet of this really long thing. I just remember the force at which I was, you know, when you're holding a kid that is just kicking and screaming and you're just like, I am not going to let you go.
Yeah.
He had that white knuckle grip on me and I was just pushing as hard as I could. And he finally just gives me this last hug and says, I'm just going to miss you, and back into this weird grip thing. And then finally he lets me go and I just get into the car, and I just understood. I got it. I knew what happened, and I wasn't going to say he was a coward. That's how I felt. I was not going to say that on camera. And I also didn't want to disparage him. I felt for him.
You loved him.
Yeah. And I felt heartbroken for him too, because I knew that he was letting go of something that I think both of us really deserved. And I think could have maybe, I don't know, you never know, been a great thing. I just knew what was there.
It feels like he didn't choose her. He chose safety.
Yeah, totally. And I also understand that. Mm-hmm. And I also respected that.
Well, one of the things you liked about him was the safety that he provided.
Absolutely. And his reverence for being really grounded where he came from. He was really lost. And by lost, what I mean is he had departed from himself in Nashville, Tennessee, where his family and his friends, which is kind of the beauty of what love really is we depart from ourselves and we allow something else to grow. But in the unfamiliar, there are a lot of risks, and I was a really big, big risk.
Yeah.
And I get that. I really do.
Yeah.
He would have been a really big risk for me too, though. Right. Huge. Huge. But I would have taken it.
Did you ever talk to him again? Ever?
Yes. And this really bizarre thing happened. I think it's the only time that's ever happened. They do this like after show where everybody gets to confront each other.
And you have to go to that.
Oh, no, I wasn't invited. I never sat down with him after that on camera, ever. And the only time that's ever happened.
That's interesting. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, I'm hypothesizing because I don't know, but I think in the same way that they shut down all the press and that you can't find anything on the internet, is that a new direction had already been scripted for him. Mm-hmm. And I think that he didn't want to have to confront me on camera. And I think that what happened between us in person, let alone on camera, was so visceral that you can't put us on camera again and then make the story that they just told on television seem true.
Did they make it sound like he and Sarah were in
love? Oh, of course.
Yeah.
If you read any of the, like, where are they now, silly, stupid, after the fact things, the way that the press has processed the story is that he chose her. They were from the, he chose his hometown girl and they broke up shortly after. But I don't think they, actually, he told me that he was forced to meet with her a few times. Mm-hmm. We didn't speak for like 6 months. I literally died awake every night in my bed. And for years after, I mean, it was brutal. I never experienced, I mean, I'd been traumatized for sure as a kid, never experienced pain like that. And then of course now, all my junk in my life is crashed on top of me on top of it because that's what happens, right? And it just destroyed me. And then I couldn't speak with him for 6 months until he called. And
did he just randomly call one day?
He did. It was after the show had aired and he said, I couldn't call you. We planned to meet for coffee and whatever. And he said, I couldn't call you. And it was really heavy. And to me, I guess, maybe a hopeless romantic, maybe a rebel, I said, screw the contract. You get on a plane and you show up at my door. And he said, I can, I couldn't, you don't understand. I said, no, I don't. And I never will. I'll never understand what it's like to know that that's what happened between you and another person and you don't address it. But we all show up differently in our lives. And I don't know how to, because it's not confrontational, because confrontation, the etymology of the word is not what we perceive it as today.
Right.
Because the word confront just means to show up to something, really. And confrontation now has a negative connotation.
Right. As if it's a fight.
Right.
Yes.
But I'm a person who shows up to things.
Yes.
And I'll show up for the beating if that's what this is. Mm. And I'll take it if that's what needs to happen to resolve conflict or confusion or misunderstandings.
Confrontation is not always conflict.
Exactly.
It's sometimes what is required to get through the conflict.
Yeah. So I didn't understand that.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that he didn't show up to just deal with it. Because I would have, you know, and granted my 26-year-old just newly developed brain was like, you John Cusack this shit. And you show up outside my window with a boombox if that's what it takes.
I don't care if it's 2006. Find one.
iPod me. You know, mail me something in secret. Yeah. You know, there's a billion ways that you could have gotten
a hold of me. Well, what does the contract say that he can't reach out to you? How long?
The whole thing was 2 years of control. So full control. And I didn't care. I would have broken that in a heartbeat. If somebody would have so much as shared an inkling of his address with me, I would have totally psycho stalked, shown up on his doorstep and said, we need to talk. I mean, I don't think I was really psycho. It might have maybe looked that way because there were a lot of emotions and it would have just been, you just need to help me understand.
Women anyway, when we have emotions and we feel like we need to address them in this moment, I'm psychotic. And it's amazing because if the man doesn't want to address it, and you do, and you express that, you know, in no uncertain terms, you're psychotic.
Wow, yeah, you're right.
He's just, I mean, he was, okay, I take back, well, no, I still think he was a coward, but I do at least empathize with him and his family situation. Like, okay, I see it. I really hope, honestly, when you're telling me the story, all I think about is my sons, and that I hope that they don't feel like they can't go for it just to please me.
Yeah.
Or my husband and myself, but like I want them to go for it in life. I think I'm approaching motherhood a little bit maybe differently from what his mom was doing. But I think that he was a coward in a way that he thought was right, and that everyone is okay with him making this choice that plays it safe and vanilla. And yet you, who's willing to fight for love or whatever it is that you believe is right, is unstable.
Totally fair.
Not okay.
Yeah, no, I do really agree with that. I think that's part of this toxic masculinity that we've sculpted as a culture and completely embraced. And you're so right about that. And I think, to your point, one of the most exemplary experiences that of that, outside of just the brutal part of it all happening, I was not allowed to even speak about it. I was totally shut down. They muzzled me. And for 2 years, I could not have sat and had this conversation with you in a way that it could have been recorded or put anywhere. They had a $5 million bid on my head.
$5 million if you talked about it.
Right. And at 26.
Now what's on top of you? Anything?
Negative.
At this point, it's all.
I'm a free bird.
Bring it, girl.
Yeah, let's
go. Have you had this conversation with anyone?
Never. Not out. I mean, this is out loud. No, I've had this conversation with here's the thing. There's three people in my life who actually understand this. One of them is my girlfriend, who's the producer. She lived this with me. She's as wounded as I am because she, the way that she would describe it is like she got to fall in love with these two people. She said it's like watching your two best friends fall in love and you were there the whole way. That was how she experienced being a producer and traveling with us and doing all this stuff. My father, because I revere and respect him tremendously. And I think he and my dad are very identical. And that's also probably the deepest way that I could speak to Travis was by really, but I really have a deep relationship with my father. We really talk about really intense, deep things. My mom, who flew to Paris, and this is the worst part, I had dinner with Travis that last night that he and I had dinner when he grills me and says, "Why don't the girls like you?" Well, I got to see my mom earlier that day and shop for dresses and rings and whatever.
Oh, like wedding dresses?
No, like it's funny. Night. Yeah, it's funny because actually I wore, what have I called it? I still have it. It's this beautiful $8,000 Escada couture dress, Paris, I mean, to die for. And it was like my black wedding dress. You get to shop for this gown that you're going to wear on the last night. And so my mom got to go shopping with me and it was just a really great, fun gal's experience. But the worst part, and I will say that my mom just brought up the other day, is that the worst thing that happened, and I would agree with her, is that by this time they knew that something, because he had to go buy a ring that day and whatever, meaning the production is, they're doing two things at once. And as I'm shopping for dresses with my mom, he had to buy the ring. And so they know that he didn't buy a ring for me, or he bought a ring. And they know that he might not have bought the ring for me.
But he's forced to buy the ring.
He's forced to buy the ring. And he tried not to buy a ring at all. And I didn't think that he was going to buy or ask me to marry him. And I was totally okay with that. I didn't want him to. That would have been, that wouldn't have been real. That would not have been.
You weren't thinking like you were going to walk up and he was going to drop to one knee.
Not at all. Not a chance in Hades.
You to continue.
Yeah. We had talked about me moving, you know, he'd bought a condo in Colorado. We talked about me moving there and I said, absolutely. We talked, you know, we were kind of making plans. We talked about house, like what kind of house do you like? Like how do you I don't know, stupid stuff that you just, you know.
Planning.
Yeah. And I actually would not have accepted a proposal from him in that context. I honestly thought if he asked me what I said, they kept trying to get me to say I would say yes. And I said, if he offered me a forever, I would accept that. But I wouldn't accept a proposal because I wouldn't have been ready to marry him at that point. But I would have been ready to journey onto that. And I also, I knew he was never going to, I just wasn't who he was. The worst part about this whole thing is that my mom was there 24 hours before all this goes down. And they knew that this was going to be brutal. And they sent her home on a flight and forced me to fly home alone. It was the worst. In fact, a girlfriend of mine have talked for years about writing a book called 24F. That was a seat that I sat in on my plane ride home. I've never had a more hellacious 13 hours of my life flying from Paris home to Los Angeles alone.
And then nobody would recognize. So the show hadn't even aired yet.
No, I was sobbing. I was just, I couldn't even, you know, when someone is just keening. I was at the airport. I could finally now get on the phone. So I call my mom to let her know I'm coming home, my family, to let them know what happened. And I'm telling them the story and I'm just, I can't get a grip. And they call the gate. And I'm the last person to board. The gal at the gate stops me and says, "What's wrong with you?" And I'm keening. I'm just crying so deeply. I can't stop, but I'm trying to pull it together. But I'm just that gut wound that your body makes a sound that is just your soul is howling and you can't stop it. And they weren't going to let me on the plane.
Whoa.
And I said, "I'm okay. I've just had my heart ripped out of my chest and I need for you to please just let me get home. And they let me on the plane. But they stopped me. All these people came over. So now it's like 10 times worse. And they're all, you know, French. And I'm like this messy American girl.
Right.
This is way before Kim K. Gosh. So it was like, yeah. You know.
wasn't
as wildly known.
Opened things up a little.
Yeah.
So your mom is sent home. You're sent mm-hmm. back
alone.
By yourself.
Uh-huh.
Does he stay in Paris?
I don't even know what happens to him.
Yeah.
I don't even know.
They carefully
all I know is my world collapsed. Like I'm just struggling to breathe at this moment. I have no clue what's happening. And I'm on a plane and I'm going home.
So you get home.
And then radio silence. That's it.
You get home and you watch this thing unfold on television.
Not until February.
Yeah.
So 4 months later.
So you got back in November.
Yeah. So just before Thanksgiving. So 4 months later, February, it starts to air. So imagine Thanksgiving to February.
And you have to keep your mouth shut.
Oh, yeah. I can't even say that I was on. I can't even say that I was gone. Like nobody even knows where I was.
Oh,
I can't say a word.
They don't even know you were on the show.
Uh-uh.
And so,
it's not like I would want to advertise anyway.
Yeah,
but
you could tell your parents obviously everything because they knew.
I had to tell my parent. I had to tell somebody.
Yeah,
and I had to tell my parents because I was going to die, and somebody needed to scrape me off my floor. Honestly, was
well, and they were on the show. It wasn't like they didn't know.
Oh, of course,
in Paris. So
yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And even when my mom flew to France, my siblings didn't even know that she was gone, they knew she was gone. They didn't know where she was.
Right.
So it was, they were really highly protective of it. And I think they were trying to revise the show or revive it at that mm-hmm. time. It had died. And I think we had the largest viewership that I think they had ever had at that point. And I think maybe even to date, almost 21.5 million people tuned in on a Monday night to watch me have my heart ripped out of my chest, publicly humiliated.
Now, let me ask you, would you do it over again?
Yeah, I would in a heartbeat. I would do some things differently, just a few. I would do exactly two or three things differently. I think that I'd never experienced what it's like to connect with another human being like that. And it was really rich and honest. And I think that it, just because of where I came from and what I experienced, and my father, who's an incredible, my mom, they're amazing people, but they had their own journeys too. And just what I went through as a kid, I learned how to protect myself. And I think that I might have been at risk for just my heart hardening had I never encountered that. And I think he just turned a light on and showed just, I think, what I explained. Just my soul. It was the first time I'd ever experienced my soul shining back at me. He, in person, exemplified what true connection, care, I don't know if you want to call it love, but it was something so not worldly and so not normal. So yeah, I would never want to go through the heartbreak again, but I'm grateful for the experience of being able to experience another human being like that. And I'm really grateful for the confrontation that the inevitable maybe judgment of his family, and I even don't want to put the word judgment because that sounds nasty. They were just caring for him. There were a lot of unknowns that they were just loving their son. And I get that. And I have a lot of respect for that. And that forced me into a massive, massive, massive full focus on really confronting my shit. Like I said earlier, I couldn't imagine being 40 plus and not having dealt with that.
Moana, there are a lot of women out there who are dealing now. I mean, you talk about the episode back with Diane. There are women who didn't go through that at 26, who weren't forced to confront their shit at 26 mm-hmm. and they do go through it. I know a lot of women who get married at 22 and they're married all these years and maybe the marriage ends or the kids leave or whatever mm-hmm. it is and they are forced to confront it. One of the things that I was really drawn to you when we were on the phone, which was probably a few months ago at least, right? At this point, we were introduced by a mutual friend and I remember I was sitting outside of the pediatrician's office because I had to go in and get my son's prescription. But I was so engaged in the phone call that I sat there in my car outside of the pediatrician. I don't even know how long we were on the phone. It was just amazing. And one thing I noticed about you was your ability to be vulnerable and your ability to not just, it wasn't surface. It was the first time we had ever spoken and it was over the phone. And it was, you gave so much of you to the conversation that I was frozen in my, like, I think when I work by myself, we talked about this when I first arrived here in this beautiful workspace, but I work from home and I think it's very isolating and you also are extremely isolated in the work that you're doing. And so I think when we had started to have a real conversation, I was like, I don't want this to end. Like, it's so nice to connect with somebody on a real level and not feel like we have to put up these walls and, you know, talk about LA this or that. It just got real. It got real fast.
Thank you.
And so I feel after hearing this that I don't know that you would be the person you are today.
I don't think so at all. After I had come back, I'm a really big reader, and Eat, Pray, Love had just come out. And page 146, she talks about a soulmate. And I would say, I think he was my first soulmate. And the purpose of a soulmate is to really change your path or your course in life. They're a reflection of you or something in you, et cetera. They're big, massive, over-the-top kinds of loves. And they change you, and they're meant to. You know, he and I ran into, it was such a silly story, but we ran into each other. We made plans to meet, and we sat down, and we talked. And then, ironically, he moved into my neighborhood, Larchmont Village.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so, you, so I'd see you've him for experienced, coffee and, okay.
Yeah. And we'd bump into each other randomly. And anyway, without getting into any of that, lives had moved on. And anyway, all this awkward tension of a whole bunch of different levels. And I don't know. It was, he was an appointment in my life that I was meant to show up yeah. to. And that is why I think making the decision to go was so, that was like a whole other big battle that I had to fight. And it's been my experience that those big things, those big appointments that I have, they just kind of strike you like that. They interrupt you and they force you to stop and to reckon with them. And that was such a big thing in my life that it did, it completely, it didn't change who I am, but it definitely changed how I've chosen to show up to things. Because as I was able to look at myself when it was available, the footage, I actually respected myself for being myself.
Nice.
I didn't feel embarrassed. There were a few stupid things that I thought, oh gosh, what, well, mostly what was I wearing? And secondly, you know, I was ashamed of not being true to myself when I had that conversation with his sister. And I probably became a little too vulnerable with him in some of our intimate moments and maybe shared with him a little additional information about life stuff that I maybe should have like held till later.
But you weren't put in the situation where it's like you date once a week, you get right. to know each other slowly.
Totally. So I totally laid all my shit out there
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
And I did share with him, you know, like a few things that probably like disturbed him a little bit. Meaning, you know, you talk, cause we, we covered everything. So your exes and whatever.
Yeah.
And I maybe like shared with him a messy piece of information or two that was a little
right.
to him. We probably would have figured out how to get over it. Yeah. I think, and the worst part about it was the way that I explained it was not accurate. So let me just break it down for you.
Okay.
We were having a really deep conversation. We were talking about our lives and he had been engaged and I was talking about my relationships and this is going to sound so terrible. I said, you know, when I was younger, I didn't protect myself in the ways that I needed to. I'd had some experiences at a really younger age that probably confused my sexuality, right? Meaning I'd had some experiences that were imposed on me as a young woman and girl mm-hmm. that made my teenage years a little confusing in regards to what sex and love are separately, yes. right? And I didn't exactly have good boundaries. And then I had made the decision a year before I chose to be celibate and to kind of reset this thing and figure out my womanhood and kind of reestablish my center with myself. Right. So I hadn't slept with anybody in over a year. And so we're having this conversation the night of. And so me sleeping with anybody was a huge deal
right.
because I had made the decision that I was not going to, because I wanted to correct right. my improper vision of what sex and love really look like because that was taken away from me. So I needed to rewrite
right.
that. And we were having this conversation. He asked me how many people I had like been with. And I, in my mind, being a girl, thinks, well, you either, you know, you hook up with somebody. It doesn't have to be actual sex, but any kind of whatever. And so I gave the number, but it wasn't like I'd slept with all those people, but he, I believe, received it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't get it then because when we're having the conversation a few days later and he's asking me why Sarah Stone doesn't like me and what the deal is with me, he kind of brings this number up in a weird way
huh.
where he says, it'd be like you, you know, hooking up with X amount of guys. And I went, oh, like it was a slap. And I think, we're on camera and I can't explain to him. Wait.
Did you give him the number off camera?
I did, yes.
And then he's talking about the number on camera.
But the way that he said it was, it would be like you. It'd be like Moana, you know, dating with or sleeping with X amount of guys. And then me, he was kind of joking,
yeah.
but it was my number. And it was totally out of context mm. because it didn't occur to me that he thought I was saying like I've slept with all these guys.
Right. But even if you had.
It, yeah, whatever. But it was one of those, just kind of lost in translation yeah. things that he totally misunderstood. This is where this gets funky. In a normal life circumstance, I would have said, wait, what? What do you mean by that? And he would have said, well, you told me that you slept with X amount of guys. And I would say, no, I meant heavy petting,
right.
making out,
right.
maybe exploring human, you know, parts.
Right.
But no.
All around.
Right. And we would have maybe had a laugh about it and moved on. But maybe that's a belief that he had about me.
He couldn't handle you. You know, I got to tell you, when I was in my 20s, I'm not going to give you a number, but it's not two. But I feel like I was a lot. I'm still a person who could be considered extra.
Yeah.
But I think in my 20s, I was really looking for that deep connection. Mm-hmm. It wasn't there. I tried to force it to be there a couple times.
Oh, for sure. That was totally my brand.
Believing,
sure.
Yeah. It was. Ultimately, I ended up with my husband, who was my friend for 4 years, mm-hmm. and I never occurred, but he knew my number. He was probably the only one who did, because I wasn't trying to impress him. I wasn't trying to hide. He was just my friend. And I think that when you get older, you realize that you need to be with somebody who's like, well, your number is just a fact. It's not, it doesn't mean it's not good or bad. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, I remember people talking about never tell each other how many people you've slept with and this and that. And like, really? Because it has nothing to do with each other.
Well, it has everything and nothing to do with the person that's standing in front of you. Meaning right. it's all part of what shaped them.
Right.
If you like the person standing in front of you, then what does the number matter? And the only thing that it really does affect is how you might feel about it, because you're measuring yourself up against them. And to that point, I would say then check yourself and ask, why is this bothering me?
Exactly.
What is this confronting in me that I need to pay attention to? To finally land your question, I would have, that was the, one of the things I would have changed, because I think that planted some seed that I was just some wild kind of whorish gal. More reason why his parents could have never accepted me. I don't know.
But more reason that he couldn't. Because
maybe so.
I think he believed that life was supposed to look a certain way. And let's for a second talk about, 26-year-old Moana and 40-year-old Moana. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe at 26 or him, for him, 30-something, that number mattered, because mm-hmm. that's what we were programmed to believe.
Totally.
And it's not until we get into our 40s, I believe, that we go, oh my God, what is that stupid story? And why am I still telling myself that story? So what are some ways that you feel like, you know, stories that maybe you were telling yourself back then
You
now are like, that is such bullshit.
Oh my gosh. So a couple of weeks ago, my mom is the director for inner healing at the Center for New Medicine in Orange County. And so she works with internal healing, so spiritual soul stuff, just emotional stuff, and also utilizes science. So there's all this great technology out there where you can put your hand on like a monitor that'll read your energy as it's leaving your body. Putting a set of headphones on with a speaker, and just like a lie detector test, when you're speaking and you're hooked up and they're reading your body's frequencies, they really kind of like read your, you know, energy and levels of conscious or subconscious truth or untruths as you're speaking and telling
I'm so
stories.
Fascinated by this.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. So I did this real kind of intensive few days with her back to back a couple of weeks ago. And you basically sit and you bring up things in your life that either affected you or you whatever. So this is one of the stories that we go through. Mm-hmm. And basically the ideal is to bring up the stories, read your energy, and then it's all comes up on a computer. Kind of like how you see those body readings where they're like an outline of a person and it's all different colors, like
right.
reading your aura. But there's full science that backs this up. And Joe Dispenza, that I mentioned earlier, is one of the leaders and thinkers in regards to all of this stuff that's been going on in science and anyway, in wellness and whatnot. So basically, your body doesn't lie and your subconscious doesn't lie. It doesn't matter what your brain, the way that it works is there are certain parts of your brain that you can just dump information into and it doesn't need to know whether or not it's accurate or not. It just receives it yeah. and it operates, right? So to your point, there are stories and things that we tell ourselves that could not be less true. And yet our brain goes, okay, all right, so that's how we operate. And one of those storylines for me that came up when I was working with my mom, and as we of course bring up this whole entire conversation, and to your point, is that I wasn't good enough. And I sadly and unfortunately believed that I was not good enough for him, for his family, for this, for my life to receive the benefit of this great big love that I had experienced. I went through my 20s and 30s and major experiences and choices, believing that I just wasn't good enough. And I stayed in a career for a decade longer than I should have because I didn't believe that I was good enough to show up to something else. And I really, without doubt, held myself back from, I think I've always tried to be connected and show up authentically and genuine to things and with people. But I also subconsciously didn't believe that I was actually really in full good enough. It's been a repeating storyline that when big things have happened in my life, that's been an issue. It's been one of those boxes that keeps dumping down. And it's been, I think, a really interesting journey as a woman to, okay, so I made the crazy choice to go and live my life out loud on this television show. And I don't regret it because I showed up totally true to myself. I found a piece of me there that I might not have experienced or found until later. I had a big love. I had a big, wildly romantic, incredible experience with another beautiful human being, for better or worse. And I found a piece of me there as well. And somehow, even still, when it didn't work out the way that I thought it could or would or should, I was confronted with this idea that I wasn't good enough for it. And so I drudged on through the next, I don't know, how many years of my life,
right,
subconsciously repeating that story. And I would say that we all have our own journey and we all have things that we need to figure out. And for me, for lots of reasons, that's been a big one. That's what happens with early childhood trauma and when you're abandoned and you don't have the formative years of love and nurturing that little kids need. You're a mom, yeah, and you know, yeah, that those things are really, 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 really highly impactful on a human being. And I'm just now 40 years old, sitting with my mom a couple of weeks ago saying, you know, I didn't realize I've lived my whole life. I'm this really what other people would perceive to be bold, strong person. I've been terrified my whole life. I've lived with so much anxiety and fear that the bottom was going to drop out because it always did. And my mom said something to me that, and this is a way that this work that she does works. So we have this conversation and she says, is it possible that you can realize that you're 40 years old now and that that little girl, when you were crying yourself to sleep, waiting for us to come and pick you up, that you can go pick her up now? She said, you're 40. You can go pick her up and hold her and tell her it's okay. You can go take care of her now. And I thought, oh my God, no, that's never occurred to me that I actually have the authority to rewrite that part of my personal pain and history and past and say, it's okay when that little girl comes up in my life because somebody says something that starts to make me feel not worthy of being taken away from a horrible experience, that I get to do that now.
Right.
And as a woman, I think that we are cultivated to believe that we need to find other things like men or a career or a family or children or all these other external things,
yes,
to create the care and provision and the identity that will make us whole. And that we are the only people who have the authority to really give the care and provision and comfort that will enable us to be whole enough to show up to other people in our lives intact, whole, and genuine, and authentic. And I wish I would have, I don't know what my 26-something, you know, 20-something, or even 30-something-year-old self would have done with that information had I received it sooner. I got it now.
Well, you're in a place to receive it.
Totally.
Who knows? Maybe the universe, people tried to teach you that lesson before in different ways, but if we're not willing,
yeah,
and open to receive, it just can't come in. But there are some people who live their lives who never receive the message. And 40 is such a young age to now have the rest of your life to continue. Because grief and trauma and all of those beautiful little boxes, you know, it's not like you unpack it and go through it and then put it back and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
It's an ongoing thing. And so that's, I think, one of the things with women, especially, you know, when I talk to women over 40, it's like, I should be over this by now, or I should be.
Oh, that's so my mantra.
This. So, yeah. And it's like, grief is, it comes up in so many different ways. It's just not the death of somebody. It's all these things that we go through in our lives. So it's
grief
not a straight.
Over your ideas.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a straight line.
Yeah.
So I think that we have to continue having these conversations. I mean, I give you so much credit to sit here with me and just talk about this and how you feel and how this journey has changed you, because there are plenty of people who could have been through what you were through and been, oh man, I was 26. What? I was stupid and he was an asshole. Like, the end. You know, I'd be out of here in 10 minutes. And the funny thing is, I didn't even plan. Yeah, like, I know that people care about the show. And so I'm like, oh, I should talk about it just because some people follow the show. But I had no intentions to make that really what we talked about. But it's just, to me, it's not your experience on the show. It's your experience in life. Yeah. And where you are now. And I just, I'm in admiration of
Thanks.
Your ability to walk back through it.
But isn't that kind of everything?
So many people don't want to go there. They're not willing. I think that's why people are going through midlife crises and self-medicating, filled with anxiety and depression and all of that. And I'm not talking about clinical.
I have all the same. I mean, I'm in no way a guru, which I don't think you're saying. I suck at 90% of this. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying it out loud also to reaffirm myself, because 100%. I don't have this down.
Yep.
And I'm still navigating through it. And the fact that I'm 40 years old having a conversation about something that happened 14 years ago
right.
with my mom as a subject of I'm confronting today tells you that I haven't totally figured it all out, that it's still something that has an effect on me or has any authority whatsoever over my thinking in any capacity. Clearly shows I haven't totally mastered anything, but I'm really focused on trying to just show up the best possible way I can to this life, and to not allow any measure of potential to be unused, to not allow any confrontation to be partial. I don't want to get hit by a car tomorrow and for anybody to say, well, she had all this potential, she could have, and all these relationships were never resolved. I'm going to do the best that I can to give 150% to every part of my life, no holds barred, relentlessly and shamelessly, to just exhaust everything that I was put on this earth to do. And I hope a lot more to go, and I haven't mastered any of it yet. I'm more afraid of not doing it than I am of living with the shit that I've drug around forever. That's why I would rather go through the pain of muscling through that experience all over again versus dragging those parts of me around with me until I really, you know, screwed some parts of my life up.
But when you describe the person you were at 26 and like, I don't want to go, I'm doing this, and like in your career, and you were like balls to the wall, which I love, you know, but at the same time, I feel like you're still that same person, but your ability to go, oh, this is going to require vulnerability. And I'm going to put it out there. Like, I don't know that 26-year-old you was willing before you went on that show to just go, I'm going to feel some things and be okay with it.
No. And what's kind of interesting too about these weird time collapsing conversations is that my 26-year-old self still has some things to teach me in reverse, because there are parts of it, if I actually really try to step back into that place in my life, I was more free thinking about certain things that it allowed me or enabled me or got me to places that I don't know how to get to now. I was very intentional and really, like, I knew what I wanted. I broke no bones about it. I felt like I was kind of grounded. I felt like I was in as much as I couldn't tell my ass from my elbow at 26, I was also pretty aware of who I was and what I wanted out of life. And although I didn't know how it was going to show up, I was even more certain of a lot more things than I even am today, different things. And some of those ideas needed to be shattered. I also had major breakups with the ideas about when you said, oh, you're turning 40. And oh yeah, I'm having that meltdown, and I've had at 30, all the ideas in 35 and at 40, the ideas of where I should have been in my life at this point. I'm 40. I don't have kids. That's a brutal argument for me to have with myself, because I never thought that I would have been 40 and not having kids and life and marriage and having a business. It's tough.
Yeah.
And I just didn't think it would be this hard. I didn't think I would feel, I feel like I'm 25 and sobbing on my floor, except I don't have the bottle of Jack Daniels next to me because it hurts too much
right.
at this age. But like, I feel pathetic and unclear and lost and confused all the time and younger. And like, I haven't figured out what my 26-year-old self had figured out all the time because life didn't stack up to the script that I had created for myself. And I was speaking with someone the other day, like maybe just around 30, and they were talking about their intentions for their life. And everything in me kind of wanted to laugh and kind of hug and encourage them. But then I realized that if the words came out, they might have sounded bitter. I just wanted to say, oh, you may want all of these things, but don't be too attached to how you're going to get there because you never know. And I didn't want to shame their ideas, but I kind of felt like life is going to get to teach them that on its own, on their own. Like yeah. nothing, I would yeah. sound bitter if I even said that out loud because it would sound like I'm just talking about all the stuff in my life that didn't go the way that but I thought it
but
should.
It's true no matter what your life is, like to be able to say to someone younger, like, hey, you may want these things, but exactly like relinquish control
yeah.
over how it all goes down because we don't have control. And I think that's what we're learning as mm-hmm. we get older, that we can prioritize a little bit the things that we still want in our lives. You know, I'm under no crazy ideas that if I decide that something's going to look a certain way, that it's actually going to show up that way.
And I think that is kind of, that is the beauty. I think that time and age, hopefully compounded with wisdom, brings to life is that I think what I'm learning and what I'm, again, this is a mantra that I have to repeat to myself in the mirror on a bad day, that when I was younger, let's say like pre-40 me, mm-hmm. I was super attached to what and how I wanted things in my life. I had an agenda. And 40 me, and hopefully 40 for the next 40 at least, I would like to be more attached to how I am and way more in control of how I show up to whatever happens in my life right. because shit is going to happen.
So let's talk about now. Oh my gosh. I mean, we're sitting in this space. I'm obsessed. I'm just going to move in here. First of all,
thank you.
So what happened after, you know, you're back, you're out of TV.
You know, it's kind of funny. I had been traveling quite extensively because I was blessed with the ability to make money. And when I was doing that successfully, I loved traveling and buying textiles and things from indigenous women that I imagined that I would do something with later, and later never happened. And eventually I decided to start a company with all these things that were piling up in a closet, making things for this important space that a lot of people don't pay enough attention to. And that's your home. The better way to say it is that I really recognize the value in the places where life happens. Sometimes it's our home, sometimes it's our office. And sometimes it's the places where our important moments happen, like our weddings or event spaces, and that these aren't just inanimate objects. These are, you know, your support system. These are the things you face plan into. It's the blanket that you snuggle up with when you have a heartbreak and you just don't want to be anywhere else other than home. And the bed pillows that you Sunday morning on with your love, and they're important essential items that comfort our lives. And so I started making these things, and again, totally transparent, placing, establishing value and context to this total safe space that I didn't exactly have growing up, and being able to create really beautiful things. And a lot of them were made by these indigenous tribal women who were weaving these textiles and putting the stories of their lives in print because that was just the way of their culture and of their world. And I had a closet full of stuff, so I started sewing.
Did you know how to sew before that?
I had sewn when I was in high school. I did, you know, the thrift store shopping,
yep.
you know, editing clothes kind of thing. And I would make things, but I didn't trust that I was savvy enough to be a designer. Mm-hmm. And I got swept up into a career, and the money
yeah.
was really yeah. too good at the time when I was really young. And, you know, you have the expense account and all the other fun stuff. So why pursue your dreams? And it wasn't until the money and all of the things that I had been chasing had zero value, and all I needed to do was pursue my dreams. And my dreams weren't exactly clear. They slowly presented themselves to me as I started making things. It was a square because it's a pillow. It was a pillow because it's a square and it's easy.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, sewing cheesy, silly zippers to finding manufacturers here in Los Angeles and having things custom made and figuring out how to take a something as simple as a zipper that you want to hide and making it something that you want to show because it's pretty. Right. And it's got a pop color. And
my listeners who can't see you right now, you're like holding up a pillow that is like so cute and adorable that, you know, you started to say something. People are unintentional with their mm-hmm. spaces, you know, with home. And we just get like, meh, you know, oh, this will work. This will cover me versus like this will be an experience when I'm on the couch.
Yeah, totally.
I think you create experiences in the ordinary.
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of like I was saying earlier that you can now show up and comfort yourself. You get to do that now.
Yeah.
You get to create this safe space when the outside world's going to be what it is. Mm-hmm. It's going to do all the things that it does. But you get to curate an environment where your kids feel safe, where they feel like color and joy and playfulness that you don't, you know, I don't know if you have no touch rooms, but that they can face plant into the sofa and it's squishy and pretty. And they always loved that blue, those pillows that mom had or their favorite blanket and they fought over. And the dinner table where life goes down and it's not just a rug underneath it. That's like, that is your grounding in your support system when you're white knuckling your seat at the edge of a conversation with your husband or with your kids mm-hmm. and vice versa.
Yeah.
And
or have friends over.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get so busy.
There's these like, really yeah. like small textures that are really, really, really integral parts of the fabric of how we do life.
I love it. So why Hunted Fox?
Oh, that's so much less entertaining. My sister and I, my younger sister, and she was in her 20s. She still is in her 20s. At the time, I had kind of thought that we would just do something cheeky and fun. And I didn't really know where I was going. I just knew I had to do something. Mm-hmm. So we landed on the idea of this common thing between us. We love Wes Anderson, mm-hmm. fantastic Mr. Fox.
Oh, yeah.
You know, companies like Wild Fox, like Fox was a word yeah. everybody was using. And the bottom line basically was that we were trying to kind of create a cheeky, way more irreverent play on the idea that we had done the hunting and the good things that were hard to find. We found them, we got them, and we're going to collect them all here for you.
Cool.
I had time. And I loved going into thrift stores when I had the patience to sit there and flip through things or I could reimagine them.
Right.
But not everybody does. And there's value in somebody who's done some of that heavy lifting and curating really cool vintage pieces or ethnic baskets and or hard to find tapestries or textiles and putting them all in one place so that you can access them. And so it was about the ability to have a really good eye, to be more creative with things that other people might generally see in a very straightforward direction and mm-hmm. be able to play with them and have flexibility. So originally it wasn't this whole kind of big, heavy, intense value of your home ethos, which right. is what it's grown into is she decided to, you know, go back to college and be 20 something and not have a company with her sister, which is totally fair and so surprising. I've really had the last couple of years, I had my full-time career for 3 years, no, 2.5 years. So I'm now, I'll be rounding out my fourth year with my company, first year totally solo, meaning that I haven't had another job. This has been my life source that I've been pumping life into it, you know, at owning your own business or doing your own thing. It's major blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah,
it's a lot.
For sure.
And the coolest thing has been, and I've shared this story a million times, and then I'm going to share it again, that I had this neon sign made when I first started my company when I was two-timing. It says hustle. Should have turned it on before you came in. And I thought that hustle, you know, you got to fight. It's got to be a hustle. And I really want to get it crossed out with like a cool, I'm not a pink girl, but I almost want to have like a hot pink neon line going right across it that goes into a script that says a line. Because when you stop the hustle and you just start doing what you're supposed to do, yes, it's a lot of work. Yes, we pulled a 2 a.m.er last night and I rolled in here all, you know, disastrous. But I'm way more aligned because the things like these jobs where we get to do the voice and the backstage and these crazy homes yeah. and these really incredible events, they fall on my doorstep. I don't even advertise that that's what we do because we kind of can't even keep up with the world just sort of presenting these incredible opportunities
right.
to us that I don't know where they come from. That alignment is a lot more satisfactory, number one, than the hustle. And really what life begins to look like when you just start moving in the right direction. And it doesn't always happen instantly,
yeah, yeah.
but it started to when I first started my company. I held on to my job and I was afraid, didn't think I was maybe worthy enough to step into this whole thing. And I white knuckled my career. And I probably missed my first window that I should have exited. And I definitely regrets, you know, you learn, and I blew it. So I could have probably accelerated some of our growth a lot earlier, but as life is, another lesson for me to learn. So as I'm moving into my fourth year, things have been aligning, yeah. But I've also had to stay focused on just showing up every day, even when it sucks. And even when I don't know where the rent is going to come from or how I'm going to pay my employees. And there have been those days, and that feels like a whole different kind of heartbreak.
But I love that you point out the difference between hustling and just showing up in a place of intention and action. It's not like hustle or sit on the couch and eat, you know, bonbons, old reference, yeah. But you know, it's show up, do what you love to do and keep doing it. I mean, you started creating and then you paid attention to the signs. Maybe some of them not as early as you could have. Whatever, you're here mm-hmm. now. Right. Yeah. And so I love that, the idea that we don't have to be killing ourselves. I was just listening to an interview with Shailene Johnson. Do you know her?
No.
She was like, she's a fitness coach or whatever, but she's kind of morphed into more of a business wellness,
not space. Angela Johnson, Shailene Johnson?
No, it's Shailene
okay.
Johnson.
I'm gonna have to look her up.
And she was talking about, I mean, here's someone who's like gorgeous, successful, all of the things that we all strive to be, right? And she was talking about how she got to the point where she couldn't even watch a movie because she felt like if she wasn't achieving, that she wasn't valuable. Mm-hmm. And that was on my way here. And so it was the fact that you've brought up some of these things. I feel the same way where it's like, you know, if I'm not moving forward in business and, mm-hmm. and doing all the things all the time, then I'm not valuable as a person. And that's not really why we're here.
Totally.
So I love that. Yes, you have to show up and when it's hard and try to figure out how to pay your employees. But I do believe if you keep living in that intention, keep doing the work and doing what you think is value for the world. I mean, your stuff is beautiful.
Thank you so much.
But you are bringing joy, you know, beauty into people's homes and their spaces and their most vulnerable spaces. We talk about vulnerability, mm-hmm. you know, when you do and you plop down on the couch and you grab that blanket and you feel like you can't show up any longer, like your stuff is right there next to them. I love that.
Thanks. There's nothing worse than a bad thud. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. Imagine, here's the way I would describe it. I would say the way I would view your home or your life is you get off a plane after a really long flight. It's been just arduous. You probably haven't eaten. You haven't slept. You've been sitting in an uncomfortable chair and you get to your hotel and you plop down on the bed and it sucks.
Oh, the worst.
A lot of people treat their homes like that.
Yeah.
Why would you do that? And it's not about just making pretty things, but they should be kind of delicious and supportive. And I'm all about texture and the way things feel. I use denim on all of my pieces because I think it's a universal textile that everyone knows. Because everyone's got a favorite pair of jeans.
Yeah.
Gets better with age.
Yeah.
It's really reliable and you can trust it. And you trust that it's going to hold up on the way you do life, by and large. And that's part of the ethos of my brand and what I do is that it's got to support you and hold you up. It can't just be pretty and it can't just be decorative. You've got to be able to literally face plant into these things at the end of any kind of a long journey. And I've had a lot of those. And I just feel like that's why I spend so much time trying to pay attention to the details mm-hmm. so that the zippers aren't scratchy.
Right.
And if they happen to be sitting on your couch because your kid put it upside down, it still doesn't look ugly.
Right, right.
And you still feel good about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, I have had such a good time with you.
Thank you.
I'm so appreciative of all of your gifts and your ability to share your story. And the one thing I have to ask you, because I ask all my guests, is what does it mean to you to 40 Thrive?
I think I'm going to circle back again to align. I want to feel stable and grounded in whatever circumstances life decides are going to show up for me. I like to just be aligned.
I love it. I think in alignment, you can then take risks.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more freedom there. I don't need to be tethered to anybody else's idea of who I should be or the right way to do something. I think I just want to firmly believe that I'm making the decisions that are really right for me because... And they may not be right for me 10 years later, but that they were actually really right for me in the moment, and that I can look back on my, just like I did on my 26-year-old self, and say, I approve what you did there because you showed up true to yourself and I respect that.
Thank you so much to Moana for joining me today. Thank you so much for listening. I truly appreciate it. Don't forget to get your 30% off at huntedfox.co. And if you liked this podcast, please consider sharing a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It means more than you know, and it actually is the thing to keep this show going. And feel free to share this episode with a friend. You know the one. She needs to hear this episode. Until next time, take care and keep thriving. Spring has sprung, and with the change of seasons, sometimes comes an increase in vitality. If you're feeling in the mood for a little more personal time, may I suggest Coconut? Coconut is all about providing clean and natural ingredients when you're enjoying your most intimate moments, with or without a partner. Naturally safe products developed by people who are obsessed with quality. Get 15% off with promo code GRONASS at grownasswoman.guide/coconut. That's 15% off with promo code GRONASS at grownasswoman.guide/coconut.